just bought me a congressman. He was cheaper than a Subaru. He needed money for his next campaign. Now he'll do anything I ask him to. 20 years on Capitol Hill. He pretends to do the people's will. But I got him in my pocket now. Well, that's the way the game is played. I got lobbyists in my pay. They're on the Hill nearly every day. Writing bills at the senator sign. They never read them, but I don't mind. Koch brothers bought a whole damn crew. They own governors and presidents too. Now they're working on the rich man's dream. 9 judges out of 9 supremes. Well, that's business in the USA. Buying senators is all the rage. Big money owns a whole damn show. And we the people get the shaft. But the people now are getting wise. You can see it in their angry eyes. Had enough of all the tricks and lies. And now they're loaded for bear. Tea Party and the liberals too. Both stewing in the same damn stew. Big money screwing me and you. And it's time we change the game. So keep voting if you think you should. The illusion might do you good. But you gotta know the whole game's rigged. Politicians don't give a fig. We had enough of this plutocracy. We can't whine and just let it be. The whole Congress is a den of thieves. And we gotta send them home. So get your pitchforks and torches now. Well, that's the only way to push them out. Standing tall on the Capitol Mall. Raise a ruckus now and sound the call. We gotta get out on the streets today. Bare knuckles is the only way. We the people gotta have our say. And you better listen up. Well, that's business in the USA. Buying senators is all the rage. Big money owns a whole damn show. And we the people got the shaft. But the people now are on the rise. You can see it in our angry eyes. We had enough of all the tricks and lies. Now we're loaded for bear. We the people gonna have our say. And you better listen up.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program and many other wonderful programs at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. And today's program is Big Brother is Watching. Heidi Bogosian talks about government surveillance, corporate power, and public resistance with Robert Scheer.
Not be as familiar as it should be to people, because it's really at the heart of the whole discussion. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons of things to be seized. It's very specific, it's very basic, it's rooted in English common law, and it had to do with unreasonable searches of the king, so it was even a limitation on the monarchy's power. It was very precious to the colonists. And one should remember when we talk about the founders, everybody always thinks, you know, particularly after 9/11, freedom is an indulgence. You know, if you're never attacked, of course, then you can have freedom. But once you're attacked, you can't have freedom. And yet we've preached to people throughout the world the virtues of limited government, the virtues of individual rights, right? And they've certainly been more threatened by violence, civil war, religious fanaticism than we have. And the founders, I'm always struck by the fact, you know, people thought, well, the founders put these protections in, but they knew more about danger than we'll ever know. If this thing had gone wrong, after all, they were going to be hung from the nearest tree, their property seized, their family killed. So when they enshrined these freedoms, they were doing it in a society that was still quite sketchy and quite open to foreign attacks and so forth. And yet they enshrined this. And when people look for the protection of privacy, they always stumble on the fact that the word itself is not used in the Constitution. So as a constitutional law person, it seems to me something much more basic than the word privacy, the sanctity of individual space. And when you read the writings of the founders, the idea was there had to be a place where you could collect your thoughts, where you could experiment with ideas, where you could discuss with your friends, where you could exchange letters, which the founders did, free from intrusion by others, and particularly by the state. And I think it's the most vivid manifestation of a privacy right that we have in any document. What is your view?
Over the years, the development of the doctrine of privacy, with notably legal scholars Louis Brandeis and Warren, enshrined exactly what you're saying, the right to personal autonomy, the right to have one's thoughts private, to reveal what we want to reveal, and to make a decision when to do so and what kind of information we want to share with others. Most troubling these days, I think, is the question. Many say, well, if I'm not doing anything wrong, I don't have anything to hide. And I think that what our founders and others realized and had the foresight to realize is that when the king or the president or those in power have the capacity to collect information on us or to peep into our private lives, inevitably that information, be it technology, which has many wonderful uses, has proven through history to be abused. And I think that many wise people and the people who wrote the Fourth Amendment, at the time it was to prevent against what were called general writs, where colonists didn't want to have the British come into their houses at night to search for anything without probable cause, the standards that has evolved over time legally, or reasonable suspicion that some criminal activity was afoot. And I think it's worth reminding people that there is no national security exception to the Fourth Amendment. And time again, we hear the argument that if you want to be safe, you have to give up some civil liberties. And that's not only not true, but I think in many cases actually makes our nation more vulnerable, both in terms of privacy and national security.
Yeah, let me just push it. One reason we're having this discussion tonight, and I must say, I got involved with this because I was over at City Lights Books, and I'm supposed to be writing, I am writing a book for The Nation and Basic Books on the surveillance state. My manuscript is due in February, and I saw this book on the shelf, and I got really pissed off. I said, oh, you know, I sat down, and which is a nice thing about City Lights Books, I was able to start reading it. I thought I wouldn't buy it. I would just read it and get it electronically somehow. And then Lawrence Ferlinghetti walked in. I was going to see him, so I thought I better buy the book. And it's a really quite terrific book. Because what it centers on is really the attack on individual freedom, the right to organize, the right to seek redress of grievances, the right to be unpopular, the right to challenge government, the assumption that government will be in the wrong, which was an assumption of the founders. And it goes through a lot of examples of where government power has been used to destroy people's freedom. And I thought about that, first of all, recently, in the last couple of days, we had further evidence of the spying on people like Martin Luther King, on the civil rights movement, on the peace movement, and so forth, on Occupy and what have you, and the labor movement. There's been a lot of examples. But one factor that's left out in this sort of, it's always been that way, is the connection between technology and privacy and what has happened. And I've not only been the object of surveillance and points in my career, but I also have been in totalitarian countries. And I've been watched by secret police. I've even been arrested in a few places. And what hit me then was that the surveillance was really, by today's standards, extremely primitive. What you're really talking about is maybe someone being able to tap your phones, some visible person outside the apartment, someone following you. All of that is antiquated now. And what you have is, I remember I started a privacy project at USC where I am a professor, and in the School of Communications and Journalism. And this was before 9/11. And I wrote an article for Yahoo Internet Life. I've always been involved with computers and the internet and so forth. And it struck me that because of this technology, things were changing very rapidly. And I didn't know the half of it. But the key things to understand is, first of all, the use of supercomputers, which become more super every hour, and the ability to sift through enormous amounts of complex data, for instance, facial recognition, checking a picture of your iris of your eye or your fingerprint now with Apple's new computer, and being able to compare, say, 20 million facial portraits in 15, 20 minutes, and to identify people.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Thank you.
And now, back to Big Brothers Watching with Heidi Bogosian and Robert Scheer.
And so it's not just a question of gathering information. In the old days, I know I'm going on a little bit, I'll just give you my own prejudice on it. In the old days, you know, you could actually assume the secret police would have a degree of incompetence. And that even though they collected information and files, did anyone ever read the files? And I know when I got my own files here, because Cecil Poole, a great federal judge in San Francisco, released a good part of my own files. A lot of it was erroneous. A lot of it was stupid, false information. And it was also clear to me, I'll just give one example, that the people really weren't reading it. I remember one file in which I was accused of being behind the Zingakuin student movement in Japan. And I couldn't figure out for the life of me how I could be behind it. I mean, I'd been to Japan and so forth. And I read, and evidently there was a manifesto that I'd written that they were studying. And then so it was translated from the English to the Japanese and back to the English. And what it was a book that I had written, you know, in 1961 on U.S.-Cuban relations with Maurice Seitlin, who was getting his doctorate here. And it was quite, you know, it was interesting, but had nothing to do with Japanese radicalism. And what it was somebody was hustling somebody in the CIA or something, and they translated this thing, and then someone translated it back, and it was gibberish by the time I read it. So there was a lot, if people have gotten their files, will say they're often disappointed. It's kind of boring and everything. Well, that's no longer the case. Now you have this massive amount of information, and it can be gone through in minutes, and certainly in real time, and you can track everything. And so that's one big factor, the fact that we have these supercomputers, and the fact that people voluntarily give up tremendous amount of information. With the new Apple, you'll give up a fingerprint, something. It would have been a wet dream for a Hitler or a Stalin, get the fingerprint of every single person in the country and then connect that with every book they buy and every movie they see and every dinner they have and do the connection with all of their friends and every phone call and every email. So you have this incredible ability to identify the individual, their tastes, their habits, their religion, their politics, their friendship, and so forth, and to sift through it and make correlations and so forth. So you have the totally observed society. The question I would put to you, is this fundamentally at odds with what we mean by the free society? Is this in itself so inherently threatening that one wonders whether you could have anything other than a notion of freedom as consumer freedom, that we want to buy, shop, have all these ads next to us and so forth, and we're willing really to sacrifice the basic ingredient of a free society, which is individualism.
With the rise of what was called years ago the computer state in the 60s, when we had some of our more primitive beginnings of computers, I read a wonderful book by a reporter, and it's called The Rise of the Computer State. I recommend it. And just going back, he foresaw everything that's happened right now, and I think it bears stating that the role of corporations have been an enormous part of how this has come about, that through developing brand loyalty with multinational corporations, we very easily hand over personal information, whether it be when you charge something, and there might be an RFID chip implanted in the article of clothing that you buy, to things as simple as filling out product registration forms that ask how many members of your family or what your habits are, that we don't give a second thought to. But we have now giant data aggregators such as Axiom, which you may have read about, has very cleverly, knowing that they're going to be subjected to more government regulation, put up a website where you can check to see what information they have on you or what information information they choose to say they have on you. And it gives you an option to correct that information and give them even more targeted data about your habits or how much money you make a year. They've done that, and it's a clever gimmick, but so are all the loyalty programs, maybe even at your coffee shop, or the apps, mobile apps that your children use that collect their data. And I think that we see a confluence of factors, one being the agencies that are charged with protecting our children and others, the FCC, the FTC, regulatory agencies that are not doing their jobs, laws that have not kept a pace with the technology that changes every day, technology that is intentionally made very affordable, so that everyone can have it who can afford it and really rely on that to conduct their daily business. And then we have a revolving door between private industry that after the Cold War really saw a decrease in military spending and had to repurpose military equipment for civilian use. I think that impacts a lot of surveillance technology, including drones, RFID technology, biometrics. So we're seeing things that used to be used for the military because of the corporate lobbyists and businesses that see this being a lucrative way to develop surveillance technology and to make the Pentagon, the NSA, and all of our government agencies reliant on them to conduct this business. Without this cozy partnership, I don't think we'd be quite at the point that you describe.
Yeah, let me explore that partnership, because the excuse that Google or Apple or Yahoo will give is we don't voluntarily turn off over information, and now with the fingerprint we're going to encrypt it and you're not going to be able to use it, it'll disappear, and so forth. But I think the reality is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the private sector hasn't put up much resistance, and that we can assume that every fingerprint will end up with the NSA or some comparable agency. And there was actually an article in the New York Times, I guess it was on the 28th, I'm not going to quote from it, but I will quote from it. Oh, do you want to quote? It's just this paragraph and you can read.
This is an article by James Risen and Laura Poitras, September 28th. The agency can augment the communications data with material from public, commercial, and other sources, including bank codes, insurance information, Facebook profiles, passenger manifests, voter registration rolls, and GPS location information, as well as property records and unspecified tax data, according to the documents. They do not indicate any restrictions on the use of such, quote, enrichment data, and several former senior Obama administration officials said the agency drew on it for both Americans and foreigners.
Right. So with that description, we can assume that every bit of data out there, right, every mortgage, every purchase, every meal, every phone call, every email, and again, because of the ability of supercomputers to digest this material, is available. So one would have to be extremely naive to think this is a power that will not be abused. And the question really is, what can you do about it? And I'm going to offer a solution, because everybody gets bummed out if we come here and it's all depressing. And what can we do? And I think a solution existed, not a perfect one, but one that, and it came up during the negotiations over the reversal of Glass-Steagall. In the 90s, I happened to cover it for the LA Times, and in the Financial Services Modernization Act, which was the basic piece of legislation. And an odd coalition formed that said, if you're going to merge insurance companies and commercial banks and investment houses, you're merging enormous amount of information, health insurance, banking records, housing records, and so forth. And you should have a privacy protection. And this coalition, oddly enough, involved William Safire, who had been Nixon's speechwriter, who was then a columnist at the New York Times, but cared a great deal, as do many libertarians. I wouldn't say he was one, but about privacy. Ed Markey, who fortunately is now a senator from Massachusetts, was then member of the House, was very concerned about it. Shelby, a conservative senator, was for it. So there was an I coalition, and they said, let's have opt-in instead of opt-out. These are the key words. And basically, opt-out is pretty much what they give you now. If you're upset about something and you want to go through a rigmarole, you could say, I want my data not used in this way. Opt-in, you would have been required to give explicit permission for your information to be merged with other streams of information and then turned over to brokers of information, people who sell it, and you would have control over how this information was used. It's all the difference in the world. Opt-in, opt-out. And Markey, as I say, and others went to Clinton and said, look, whatever we think of this bill, which is a horrible bill, and brush it in the economic crisis of the last 8 years, if you're going to sign it, which you seem determined to do, why don't you at least have this opt-in protection over the records that are being merged? And Clinton refused to do that. He promised it first, and then he betrayed that thing. Now, that remains a very, again, you're the person that I want to address this to. What do you think about that? Is it too late for an opt-in requirement? Is this the battle we should be having?
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.